had to go about it, write it out, and find it myself. And there's some stories I can tell you. It's the Final Word Cricket Podcast, Season 13, Episode 12. An episode we didn't think we would be recording. We thought this test match would still be going. But I'm on the other side of the world already. It's still day four. Mm-hmm. Jeff's still in Brisbane. We've got the Christmas ep in a couple of days, but we thought, why not put the recorder on, talk a bit of baseball, talk a bit of Australia's women in New Zealand, do a little bit of Nerd Pledge and see where we land.
New Zealand. I didn't realise they'd got
where are they?
They're. I'm currently watching them.
India. I'm in India. Don't know why I said New Zealand. Yeah. It's not as though those two countries are sort of peas in a pod or anything.
They don't have a lot in common, generally speaking, aside from being in ICC finals together.
But isn't it great that events have transpired in such a way that we'll get a chance to talk about the two-day test as well and the wash-up from that, the pitch rating and so on. I know everybody wants to know what we have to say about the pitch. I judge that based on social media. But yes, as I say, I've had enough time to cross the planet, as I did on night two of the test match, get home, have a full night's sleep, effectively break jet lag, wake up early, do our Christmas interview, go to yoga, do an interview about baseball, and jump back on the line with you. It's all happening. Can't stop, won't stop.
How did yoga go for you? Because if anyone hasn't seen the bathtub episode, you trying to get into the bathtub was, I mean, you know, it didn't speak of great flexibility.
That's true. That's a function of my bad back from cricket, though. Like the moving around, and I have bad hamstrings from cricket as well. So that's partly why. But I've learned how to, as they say in yoga, modify my postures. And the fact that it's 40 degrees in the hot yoga that I do, to be honest, I haven't gone an awful lot this year and I'm feeling a bit sluggish after three-ish months in Australia eating press box food every day and that kind of thing, and generally not, but you know, not, you don't sleep as much as you otherwise would. You probably have a beer more days than you otherwise would when at home. So that's the process of getting beach fit. I don't know what for exactly, having a baby in a month's time and eating shit again, but still, it's what I've been doing.
Revenge body. You've got to get your revenge body together. I don't know who you're having revenge on, but somebody. Look, it has been a weird week. It is still day four. We have recorded our Christmas special with Simon Katic. We'll let that cat out of the bag, if you will. That'll be released on Christmas Eve, so you can have something nice to listen to if you need to hide from your family at some point over those couple of days, or you have a long car trip or whatever it is. Today we're talking to Cameron Ponsonby later in the episode, who's in Pakistan, English journalist who's been following that wild test tour over there. And, you know, it couldn't have been much more wild over here. It's been a strange few days after a two-day test match, something I've never seen, something that has only ever happened in Australia once, and that was in 1931. To me, it felt interesting to be part of history. You know, we saw something historic. We saw something that's not likely to be repeated.
That's a great bit of spin. I feel like I've seen two-day test matches recently because I suppose the cumulative overs at, where were we? At the Oval earlier this year. It didn't meet
Gaul as well.
And two this year. So that's the third two-day test in effect that I've seen this year. I'm getting unfortunately used to it. And even Hobart, I reckon there was time taken out of that test and that was over, you know, inside 3 days to start our year. So of the 15 test matches I covered this year, three of them have, you know, barely got out the block. So, or maybe four. Yeah, that's not, I find that uncomfortable. And I think about the surface, the more I've had a chance to step back from it and think, and as you do when, you know, in the heat of the moment when we were recording the other day, we didn't get a chance to go through that in any real depth because I was, as it happens, racing to the airport trying to make that flight. It was quite chaotic, by the way. I was, after I left you, hailed a cab on Vulture Street. You had to go the other way to get me back to where I was staying. And I was on the phone on loudspeaker to the airline and it just kept dropping out. So I had the same conversation with four separate customer service reps who clearly weren't in Australia, which is fine, but like it was billed as the Australian call center, but I was being, you know, so there's that delay on the phone. And the fourth one I got onto, I'm like, please take my phone number down. Please call me back if the phone drops out. And I got on that flight. I had that flight booked for me 100 minutes before it was set to take off. Then I jumped in the cab. You know, it was real. It was worth it, obviously, because I got to pick up Winnie from nursery yesterday. It was a big surprise and it was all very lovely. But yes, all of that was possible due to the surface in a way. My gut feel is that would have got really nasty on day three and four because of the ball marks and they were firming up. They were becoming more of an issue. The four wickets that Australia lost in the second innings, although I'm not saying Khawaja's was directly related to that, but the balls that came before it, the one that was hitting the stumps and just missed off stump, the one that reared up at his throat from roughly the same spot of the pitch. When you see balls with variable bounce like that on day two, it suggests that if you get to day four, it's going to be a minefield. So in a way, maybe it's a good thing it ended so quickly, so no players were put in the and look, there'll be people who'll say, oh, these cuck simp batters have it fucking handed to them these days. They can do whatever they want. They get to make shitloads of runs at Rawalpindi.
These soft boy milk fed.
Exactly.
Types.
They don't know what it's like to bat the Battle of the Ridge and all that. And look, uncovered pitches. Yep. You know, Bradman. And some of that is true.
Bradman used to bat with an explosive collar around his neck that if he played and missed, it would detonate and blow his head off, like the movie Fortress. That's what used to happen.
The collar bomb. That takes me back to the Sydney media cycle of 2011. That's really niche. But you know what I'm trying to say? Like, there are some people out there who will just argue until they're blue in the face that this is bullshit and the pitch was fine and the batters were a bunch of softcocks. But I don't know. Steve Smith said this on the record later in the day. If Steve Smith has played, I don't know, 90-odd test matches, he's saying he's never seen anything like that ever in Australia, probably worth paying attention to Steve Smith. Like, we shouldn't be disregarding what he has to say about the surface, given these are the guys who are out there on the 22 yards and playing the game.
That's also a level of spin because what Steve Smith said was that was the most challenging surface I've played on, which doesn't necessarily mean that was an impossible surface to play on. Pat Cummins talked about it in the press conference and said, yeah, it was bowler friendly and it was hard to bat out there, and that doesn't necessarily mean it's a problem. Dean Elgar said that he didn't like it and he thought it was an unfair pitch, but you know, Dean Elgar says things to annoy Australians fundamentally. I mean, you know, if anybody's read the piece I wrote in The Guardian, you'll know my argument on it. But basically the way I see this is that the curators at the Gabba were not trying to make that pitch. That's not what they set out to do. Yeah. They set out to make something grassy and bouncy and something that would give some life to the bowlers, but they're also dealing with the conditions and the weather and the fact that it's been a very cool summer and they haven't been able to bake the pitches and all the rest of it. There's so much variability that goes into a pitch. So, yeah, they probably wanted a greenish pitch, but it's not like it had a lot of grass on it. It had 5 mils of grass. That's less than you see in Perth, less than you see in Adelaide, all of the rest of it. They weren't trying to make a two-day test pitch. It fucked up in one way or another. It had too much moisture in it. And so it wasn't the pitch that they wanted to make. And my argument is that that still doesn't necessarily mean that it is a massive problem. It means that it's an outlier. It means you're not going to get a lot of surfaces like that. And if you very occasionally do get a surface like that, then I think that's okay. I think that is a degree of difficulty that makes the spectacle more interesting. It wasn't dangerous while the players were out there. If it had been dangerous, you've got umpires there to make a ruling on that, you know, and they can and will do that. We saw that in the Sheffield Shield a couple of years ago with that MCG pitch that was all over the place. We've seen pitches in South Africa that have behaved like this. Remember that India-South Africa test a couple of years ago when the ball was going absolutely crazy, going everywhere. That Brisbane wicket was not behaving like that. It was difficult, but it wasn't impossible to play on. And we saw that from the way that Kyle Varane played, from the way that Travis Head played, even from the way that Kai Zondo played at the end. If you were willing to take on the bowling, if you changed the way that you saw the game, which was rather than hang around and try to defend and try to hang in there, you try to score, because if you score quickly, then you can give your team an advantage. That's what Travis Head did. That's what Cameron Green did. That's what Steve Smith did. And between them, they gave Australia a lead, and that lead ends up being decisive. And that point where South Africa are 3 wickets down for 5 in the second innings, they shut up shop for about an hour and didn't try to score. And to me, that's where they lost the game. If they'd been willing to try to take on the bowling at that point, they might have got away with it, and they might have been able to get the 50 or 60 extra runs they needed, and that might have been enough to win them the test match. So, yeah, it's not ideal. You don't want every pitch to be like that. You don't want every test match to be 2 days. But the game that we saw, I think, was thrilling. It was exciting. I couldn't take my eyes off it. The people who were there got a great treat. The people who had day 3 and 4 tickets, yeah, hard luck, but equally you might rock up on day 3 or day 4 and watch it rain all day. Like, there are no guarantees in live sports. So, you know, I thought it was fine, and obviously you get dragged down the red herring of what about spinning pitches, and you go, well, okay, we're not talking about that. And it's also fine to have a spinning pitch that favours spinners as long as it's possible to bat on it, you know, and those kind of games where you see Rohit Sharma peel off 160 and then England get bowled out for 110, well, obviously you can bat on it if Rohit Sharma can make 160. So the same logic applies, but it has been absolute nonsense how it's everything has been dragged towards, oh, what about turning wickets? You guys aren't talking about turning wickets. Well, we're not, because that's not the current thing under discussion.
Yeah, and look, I think last year, I think most of what you said then is pretty fair. Last year when there were a couple of brisk test matches in India, I think there was a distinction we drew at the time between Ahmedabad, it was over in 2 days, but that was mostly due to the, well, I think we learnt after the fact, didn't we? It was the SG pink ball, which had not been used in a test match and really skidded on, and it gave the England batters...
And broke through the surface through more. The surface, it, there was something to do with the hardness of the lat. It skipped on more quickly and it was pretty much impossible.
And then the other one that stood out, I think it was the second test at Chennai, I think it was anyway, where it was breaking through, like you're describing there, it was breaking through the surface on day one. That was designed to do that. Whereas I think you're right, I don't reckon the Gabba curators were going out there to try and fuck shit up. I think it was just a climactic thing. You know, they'll be gutted, right? I think the curator's been quoted in the press. They're devastated that it's played out this way, as they would be. It's their profession. They've copped a demerit point from the ICC, which doesn't mean anything in practice, because I think you need to rack up 4 demerit points to have a test match taken away. So you need to have an even worse pitch than that.
Rawalpindi's had 2 in a year and they're still...
That's right. You need to get effectively 2 negative 2s in a row, if that makes sense, to miss the next one, and that's not going to happen here. So generally speaking, I agree about... I quite enjoy low-scoring test matches where runs are at a premium, because we see a lot that are the other way. And what you're describing there about making runs quickly and taking on the bowling, that's how it was in Pune back in 2017, another pitch that got docked at the time because it was exploding on day one. But yeah, I think most of this is the usual parochial bullshit, right? It's my pitches are better than your pitch because my country's flag is this and your country's flag is that. And the massive, massive chip on the shoulder that some people have got, which is fucking weird. I mean, honestly, India runs world cricket. You don't need a chip on your shoulder if you run world cricket. It's won. It's over. The game is up. Now, what India wants in world cricket, it's the hegemony. And you know what? We're all at peace with that. Well, I say at peace. We all accept that. That is the reality. The BCCI run world cricket, which means that if you're a follower of the Indian team, you needn't have a chip on your shoulder. What you want will roll. It doesn't really matter anymore. This sort of fucking ongoing culture war just drives me insane. And we saw so much of it on Twitter the other night. Why aren't people going to bag the Brisbane pitch? I mean, fuck me. But people...
Everybody was, literally
it's
everybody
just this disingenuous,
in the world.
It's just this disingenuous, same old bullshit, woe is me nonsense about India, which makes no sense because India literally runs world cricket and have, a lot of the time, the best players in the game playing for the national sides. That should be celebrated.
I think for the most part, the people with the chip on their shoulder about this are not really cricket supporters. They don't really care about cricket. They care about patriotism and they care about nurturing a grievance.
Sure.
And that's about it. But if you're talking about purely cricket-related things, if you have, and this point was made by a couple of people, if you have a green top, it stays pretty much the same for both sides. There is advantage and disadvantage inherent in it, but it can be exploited or not exploited by one side or the other. If you have an underprepared spinning wicket, then it tends to get worse as it goes on.
Yep.
And so the earlier you can play on it, the better. And so then there's less evenness in terms of the volatility of the surface. So that can be the case. But if you have a standard turning pitch that is consistent for over the course of 3 days, then you can get a result and it'll be about who bowls spin better and who plays spin better, which is absolutely fine.
Yeah, what I observed with this pitch was that it was getting harder to bat on, which is the opposite. By that I mean it wasn't the greenness of it, because that was a bit deceptive, right? Because the grass was only 5 mil. It wasn't as though it was Trent Bridge 2015, for instance, which was set up for what played out and set up perfectly. They were hoping to get Australia in on that, having struggled against the moving ball at Edgbaston. It just was the execution 10 out of 10. Whereas this was, it felt like it was those ball marks that were hardening up as the sun baked the pitch, and that's what increased the degree of difficulty to a point where, and it's impossible to know, but again, it's my cricket antenna went up as that day was getting deeper and deeper on. I mean, remember, it wasn't even a third session on the, I think the test finished before tea on day two, or at least they extended the middle session to that point, something like that. So imagine what it would have been like another day on. We will never know. All right, Jeff, let's move off that second test match. Of course, starts on Boxing Day. You will be there doing dailies at the cricket ground. I will not, because I'm going to attempt to do some broadcasting from the other side of the world, and we'll go to bed at roughly tea each day, so I won't be quite there for the daily shows. But Jeff, you'll have a partner with you. I'm not sure if you're planning on keys in the bowl approach and having a different person each day, or whether Basilenko is going to be with you throughout. But either way, I'm sure they'll be great. I'll be listening when I wake up.
I haven't even thought about it yet. We'll work that out sometime after Christmas, I think.
Australia's women have been in India, not New Zealand, this five-match series, which has been absorbing stuff. Elise Perry, just when we think she might be finished as a T20 cricketer, Jeff, this has happened a few times in her career, right? Just when we start thinking, oh, maybe they'll move on from her, maybe the balance of the side won't see fit to have a slower-paced middle-order player and a bowler apparently past her peak, she goes and has a series like this.
Yeah, I mean, this is fascinating to me. She gets left out of the T20 side during the Ashes, the multi-format, so she plays the 50 overs and the Test match, but doesn't play the T20s. Rides the bench for the Commonwealth Games, you know, has a gold medal, better than Steve Waugh, all the rest of it, but doesn't get a game in the Commonwealth Games. You've got Tylee McGrath being the sort of, you know, the T1000 version of Elise Perry, you know, coming in and flying the helicopter and getting frozen by liquid nitrogen and all of the rest of it. And you're thinking, well, okay, you know, maybe that's it. Maybe time's moved on. This T20 series, we talked about the first couple of games when we last did a weekly show. The third game, they're all at the Brabourne Stadium. Perry batting middle order as well. So bear in mind, she's done most of her good T20 work for the Sixers opening and batting through an innings. That's been the Perry way, you know, making anywhere from 70 to 120, depending on the day, at, you know, not a run of ball, but not a million miles ahead of that. Batting at four in the third game, she makes 75 of 47 balls. I mean, at least Perry doesn't score like that, but is
she did for one big bash, right? And that was the outlier.
Yep. Even then, it was strike rates of about 120.
Right, yeah. You
know, like, it was quick for her, but it wasn't super, super quick for everybody else. Hitting a bunch of sixes as well. They defended that score safely. The fourth match, batting at number five this time, she makes 72 not out off 42 balls. Hits a bunch of sixes again. Australia 188 for three. Close game. They defended it by seven runs. Risha Ghosh did her thing at the end and smashed 40-odd in no time. And one of those ones where it looks closer than it was on the scorecard. Yeah. You know, actually watching the match live, they were always further behind than they ended up looking like they were, and were unlikely to quite get there and didn't quite. And then the fifth game is actually happening live right now. I'm watching it while we're talking. Perry 18 off 14 balls, so no mucking around there either, you know, coming out and hitting from the off. Grace Harris, meanwhile, been going absolutely crazy. 27 not out of 12 balls, 41 off 18, and then tonight 64 off 35, 100 plus run partnership with Ashley Gardner, who was also 60 odd not out. So two interesting storylines, which are Harris, who's been a satellite player for years and years and years. You know, remember her playing a couple of T20s in 2015 in the Women's Ashes that year that we were at. She got a gig in Cardiff and hit a couple of sixes in an innings there, but rarely got the opportunity. And then Perry saying, well, I'm going to be a middle-order hitter because Rachel Haynes is retired. Meg Lanning's not currently playing. Elisa Healy's done a calf and is out of this game, and Tylee McGrath's captaining. There are gaps in that team, and there are lots of sort of up-and-coming contenders, but there's Perry saying, well, maybe I'll turn myself into a different kind of player again.
I just want to talk about Grace Harris. I think we've backed over this a couple of times through the year, but it is a great story. You mentioned those 2015 T20s. She was Ash Gardner before Ash Gardner was Ash Gardner. She effectively got overtaken by her, right? I sat with her at breakfast.
Off-spinner who could hit sixes.
And hit plenty of them on the opening day of the Big Bash in 2015, the very first day of that women's Big Bash competition. She hit 100 at the Junction Oval at a strike rate of 200, right?
Yeah, so 50 balls.
Yeah, so she changed clubs. She has had a number of injuries, had that shoulder problem for a couple of years as well. But last year gets finally recalled for that Women's Ashes. It was this year, wasn't it? Start of this year. And went on the World Cup trip. And yeah, had breakfast with her one morning. We were at adjoining tables in at Fairbreak and was kind of talking about all this with her. Sitting there as I was with Rach and Winnie, I'm sure they were thrilled with the really deep deep chat about numbers in the WBBL. But, you know, it was nice to get Grace's perspective. And I think she said a version of this on the record at the time. She basically got taken on the World Cup trip she said this offhandedly, because she was just a really good person to have around the squad. You know, a sensible, mm-hmm. measured, experienced, grown up, right? So didn't play, having been, I think she got two TFCs in the Women's Ashes when rain affected games in Adelaide. But now gets her chance. And, you know, funny that, experienced player who's had to get back in via a sheer weight of runs, finally gets the chance to play and dominate. You hear of this so often. So absolutely chuffed for her making all of these runs. Who knows where the Grace Harris story goes from here? Maybe it doesn't go much further, right? Maybe they, you know, they have a younger player who can do something similar and they move on from her pretty quickly. But there's a World Cup around the corner and she'll be part of their thinking for that. That's in February and March when we'll be in India for the Border Gavaskar Trophy. Unfortunately, we can't be in South Africa for the Women's T20 World Cup, but Grace Harris will be. And what a great yarn it would be if she went full circle and they win the comp, as they almost certainly will, and if she's there standing on the dais with a medal around her neck.
I think she'll be more than in their thinking. I think she's a lock for that because
The key
was that Commonwealth Games structure, and she was in that 11 every time. You know, she was the one they wanted to turn to provide the power down the bottom of the top order, if you will, to come in at 6 or 7 and be the one who could hit, who could float a bit and come in towards the end and really finish off an innings. So I think, and with the way that she's gone in this series, then surely she's not going anywhere between December, it's nearly Christmas now, and once they get going on that tournament in less than a couple of months' time. So I think we'll definitely see her get that opportunity. And I mean, the way she's going at the moment, she just looks, she always looks like she's having a great time out in the middle. But to be able to do that when playing for your country is a particular skill. Not right now, because she's just dropped a catch and she looks really pissed off. She slipped out. She lost her footing on the wet grass as she was running back trying to get a catch at cover. And I think they've got her on the player mic as well, because she's talking to somebody. Maybe she's just talking to herself. But yeah, for the most part, she looks like she's extremely cheerful to be out there.
Yeah, when she finishes a player, she's going to be really good on commentary. That's for sure. Jeff, it is 3:15 local time in London on the 20th of December, which means it's one day before the shortest day. The sun's not far from setting, and I'm going to try and take Winnie out of nursery early to go and buy a Christmas tree. So let's gallop along and do Nerd Pledge and then get out of here.
All right, let's do it.
Because we've already done our, I should say, because we've already done our interview. This is the magic of podcasting.
Yep. So I'm not going to yell Nerd Pledge because it's 1 a.m. in Brisbane, but Nerd Pledge is a game that we play with people on the internet. If you don't know how it works, the way this show gets made is that lovely people fund it voluntarily. They send us contributions that are not normal denominations. They're very specific numbers that relate to cricket in some way, and we have to work out what the number means. Rosie Piper is the pledger this week. The number is $5.42. 542 could mean anything in any organisation of those numbers. Decimal point could go anywhere, 542.
And there's a clue for you, Jeff. You're going to solve this one. If I were a far richer woman, the decimal place wouldn't be where it is.
Well, a couple of ways to look at this. You could move the decimal point one place. You could make it 54.2. You could wonder if that's a batting average. It is a batting average. It's two batting averages. It's Charlie Davis and it's Vinod Kambli. We've talked about Vinod Kambli on the show before. I mentioned Charlie Davis last week. Charlie Davis is an underreported cricketer. One of the members of the 50-plus average club, once you take into account that you need to have played 20 innings and all of that to qualify, Charlie Davis qualifies, played for the Windies in the late 60s, early 70s. I think I'll tell a Charlie Davis story another time, though, because I was thinking about telling it and then I thought, well, what if I move the decimal point one more place? Mm-hmm. And that seemed more in keeping with what we've been talking about recently. Because if I made this number 542, we've talked a lot in the last few weeks about West Indies being not very good. We talked a lot to Simon Kadich for the Christmas show that you will hear very soon about being a player from Western Australia who's pretty good and makes lots of runs in the Shield. What if we put those two things together and said, Adam Voges, 542.
Of course.
His career average against the West Indies.
Of course.
Four innings, three centuries, including that 269 not out in Hobart. 542 runs once dismissed. One of the most infamous numbers in a way, Adam, that goes around in modern cricketing parlance.
Yeah, and I was at all of those test innings that he played, so I feel somewhat well informed on the life and times of Voge as the test player. I just want to say for the record, his 100 at Dominica on debut was an outstanding innings under immense pressure. That feels impossible given the Windies as we conceive of them now, but on a spinning track at Dominica, Devendra Bishu was bowling outstandingly well. He picked up Brad Haddin with, you know, what we described jokingly on Caribbean Broadcasting Corporation. I was on comms then. It was my first test match doing comms, like, you know, grown up comms, if you like, having talks my way into that commentary box. And I described it as reminiscent of the ball of the century. Went back into the press box, said it to a couple of colleagues, and I think Greg Buckle worked out it was the same date as Shane Warne's ball of the century, and they're away. That was the news line. And Bucky went into the press conference and asked, I think it was Dinesh Ramdin, the Windies captain at the end of the day, about this delivery. And I like laughed, and Buckle, as was his way, I hope you're listening, Greg, got stuck into me saying, fuck, it's your fault I'm asking it in the first place. You're the one that fucking said it. Mate, I'm just laughing because it's funny. I'm not criticizing you at all. This is brilliant that this is coming up again. Anyway, the Voges 100, I reckon he was on about 70-odd when Australia's eighth wicket fell. Hazelwood puts in a magnificent effort at number 11 after copping a ball to the face from Shannon Gabriel. I reckon by modern concussion standards, he probably wouldn't have continued his innings and Voges would have been stranded on about 80. That was after Nathan Lyon put in a shift with him as well at number 10. So they got him close enough and Voges ends up on about 120-odd not out. It was a really great end to his golden summer where he made six centuries for WA to get on the plane in the first place. He broke Chris Rogers' record for most runs in a Shield season for WA, about 1,500 of them or something ridiculous. And then, yeah, the 269, a little bit less sporting. And by that, I mean they were always going to do it. They were going to do that week in Hobart. And I suppose the second innings, the other 100 was, it was at Wellington, Jeff, the test we were at.
That's the New Zealand one. But that's his other double 100. But I think he made one in Melbourne.
Oh, Melbourne, yeah. That was one where four Australians made hundreds in the innings, which is a fairly rare feat. Joe Burns, Usman, I reckon Smith and Voges all cash in. And, you know, by that point of the tour, the Windies are stuffed. But still, you got to make them. And he did. Routinely against the Windies. The only time he was out was at Jamaica in the second test match where he still passed 50.
And the partnership with Sean Marsh that was it 448?
It would have been, well, what's the partnership between Bradman and Ponsford? That's 4.
Bradman and Sid Barnes.
Bradman and Barnes, right, 452. Yeah. Then it's one or two short of that. It might be 449. Yeah. I remember Jim Maxwell, who we were working with that week, being so grateful that sort of totemic number wasn't overtaken in a test where, I mean,
in a three-day test in Hobart.
Yeah, I want to tell you a story about Jamel Warrican, the man the authorities came to blame for that absolute annihilation. He couldn't land it on the
cut
strip.
Because Bishu couldn't play because it was too cold.
That's right, his fingers.
The first morning in Hobart, there was snow on the mountain behind Hobart, and Bishu, as a leg spinner, couldn't grip the ball, and they went, "Well, we'll have to play the finger spinner instead."
Yeah.
The poor old West Indies all shivering in their like several layers of cable knit jumpers and all the rest of it. It was. Look, I mean, you can talk about 2-day tests and 3-day tests. That was a 3-day test that wasn't really worth watching, as opposed to the 2-day test in Brisbane, which was worth watching.
A rare time where Australia enforced the follow-on, so they get the extra day off and got to go home on the Saturday. In fact, they stayed on the Saturday, didn't they? Because we ended up with them at about stupid o'clock when Adam Voges had really enjoyed having been out of the match, put it that way. He was he'd had a big session.
Right, so that is the Nerd Pledge of 542, I'm guessing, for Rosie Piper. Pretty confident about that one. If you want to play Nerd Pledge, go to patreon.com/thefinalword. Help us keep making the show. We would very much appreciate it.
All right, let's take a breather, Jeff. Then we will be talking to young gun journo in Pakistan, Cam Ponsonby.
Hi everyone, you're listening to The Final Word. It's Ishigua here with Adam Collins and Jeff Lemon.
Final Word, Adam Collins, Jeff Lemon, and we are joined in Karachi at the Movenpick Hotel. Jeff, a place you and I know very well, by first-time guest on the show, cricket writer, cricket analyst, broadcaster, very good shitposter as well, Cam Ponsonby. Welcome along at long last. How's your tour been? Last night of it.
It's memorable. I think memorable is the premier word. I'm having to work out what my kind of stock response is going to be for the trip, because all three places have just been... have been so different. Like Rao, I think you guys were out in Rawalpindi and Karachi. Rawalpindi is kind of beautiful town where like your grandparents live there. It's quite quiet. You go up into the mountains. Karachi is amazing, kind of bustling city. Kind of feels like it's like, as a London boy, it's more recognizable, but also completely different. Great funds we had. And then like Multan was shit. So this is like the kind of how we work it out. And it's one of those things we didn't get out at all. We weren't allowed out. So, I think I would rephrase that to, I couldn't pass judgment on the city that I never saw, but we're in effect locked down and just kind of were within the confines of our hotel. So it's been such a mixed trip, so memorable. And yeah, I'm interested to know how kind of the rose-tinted glasses will affect it over time.
Yeah, and it will. I mean, Jeff and I have gone through that over the last 6 months. Everyone wants to know what it's like in Pakistan. I think it's my favourite tour. We got out a fair bit and we weren't restricted in any of the cities that we went to. But I know when we were in the hotel where you are now, I see a Vish over your shoulder there, where you've been staying, or you're not staying at the Movenpick, but you're in Vish's shack at the moment. There's that cigar lounge or cigar bar, which is like a nondescript door. And when you push through it, you're hit by a puff of cigarette smoke, and you can get, I think from memory, is it you can get beer or you can get bourbon, that's about it, or maybe whiskey, and that's your lot.
I'm so disappointed to find out you guys spent a lot of time there, because I've spent an hour in there and I was ashamed. It's £12 for a Heineken, £6 for a Murray. And the Murray, the only way I kind of drank it was if I was imagining I was in kind of Amsterdam or Belgium, and it was actually a very kind of fine, kind of wheaty beer. But I think it's been mainly certain England staff members / players and Barmy Army people have been propping up the bar there. And I've been away, so I've been the healthiest I've ever been in Pakistan. It's all been fine. I mean, basically been teetotal.
That cigar bar, I'm going to put that in inverted commas. Imagine me doing air quotes, because the first thing is that they don't sell cigars. That was the first thing Bharat asked when he went in. And no, just out of curiosity, not that he's a cigar smoker. The second thing is that everything on the menu they didn't have. So, you know, can I get a Johnny Walker? No, we don't have that. Okay, can I get a gin and tonic? No, we don't have any gin. Okay, what can I have? Oh, you can have local whiskey, or you can have a Murray beer. And thirdly, it was just the most depressing room I've ever been in my life. It was just a sort of sad, it was like a large coffin. And nobody was smoking cigars in there. There was no sense of grandiosity or anything. It was a tiny hole where you went to hide the fact that you were drinking booze in a hotel, and it just happened to be the only place where you could do it, so you ended up going back. I've been in some absolute shithole places. I've lived in some absolute shithole places, but that was the most depressing room I think I've ever been in my life.
A lot of sour cream and onion Pringles though. So if that's your tip of choice, get yourself down to the Movenpick cigar room on level 9, and you'll be laughing.
It's the contrast to what we had in Lahore. Sorry, it's just turning into a bit of We Love Pakistan chat, but you didn't get to Lahore, which is a shame, Cam, because that's got the room 424 in the hotel that everybody stays at, the Intercon, which is a proper sports bar. And we got to know Sultan, the bar owner, quite well, playing pool with him every night. And kind of what you're describing there with the Barmy Army, it was Lukey Sparrow's lot who are the waving the flag. I think they're called something else now, but they used to be called waving the flag, the tourists that would travel with the Australian side. They were there every night, and it was a pretty small crew. So it was like all Australian media and associated travellers were in the same place every night, and they were very good memories. But I suppose Multan, just to say you've ticked it off the list, it's another place you've seen Test cricket. And who would have thought for you personally, I think we caught up about a year ago and you were kind of working out your place in the cricketing world and you weren't quite sure whether you were going to stick with it or not, that a year on you've toured the West Indies and now Pakistan, which until a couple of years ago would have been inconceivable for anybody.
Oh no, absolutely. I mean, it's been an amazing year, and I think Multan will kind of elevate my kind of memories over time, because it just, on every given day, something happened where I was like, oh fuck, that's never happened to me before. And kind of you arrive, you touch down, you go into your hotel, and I'm freelance, so I'm staying in hotels away from the teams, away from everyone else. And I got in and they just went, they looked at me, they're like, no chance, mate. And I was like, what's going on? They're like, no foreigners allowed. I was like, oh my God, like what? I'm like, what do you mean? There was only four or five hotels in the whole city that kind of were allowed to have foreigners stay there. They had the license. And so within half an hour, I was saved by a kind of British Pakistani lad named Hassan, who paid for my night in my first hotel, the first night of my hotel in Multan. I'm in so much of a debt. But I was then transported from this hotel to a different one on the back of a motorbike with two lads who also worked in the hotel, carrying my 20 kilogram suitcase, weaving through the streets of Multan, get to another place where they put me up for one night and say, no more, sir, there's no more room. And then eventually they agreed to let me stay forever or for the week. But it was utterly bizarre. We had to get a police escort everywhere. There was Inspector Ali, who the first time I met him was the scariest bloke I've ever seen in my life. Like, he's got the beret on, he's got the moustache, he's a big lad, he's got his gun on his hip. And on the first night where he said to me, you're not going anywhere, I went, yeah, that's a good point, actually. I haven't thought about it that way. I'll stay right here. And then as soon as he found out I worked in the cricket, all of a sudden we were best mates. And it was queue jump everywhere, because everyone else in the hotel was the people in the same boat as me. English fans who'd booked into hotels and found out they weren't allowed to stay there. Ah. So every morning when I was going to get picked up by the car, because we had to get a police convoy to the ground, I always had to move myself to the other hotel where most of the journalists were staying. And what I was meant to do, the official process was I should have gone on the bus with all the other fans that went in the convoy. And I went, I can't do that. I need to get there earlier for press purposes, etc. And so I hopped on the back of a police motorbike every morning and I got ferried up the road, basically, and had this my own personal kind of courier service. And it was all completely surreal, because you're there, that they care so deeply about your safety, and that's why all this security is there. But at the same time, you hop on the back of someone's motorbike without a helmet on, which is kind of inconceivable in the UK, kind of going up the wrong way, up one-way roads. It was a process. If you had to go the right way from this hotel, you had to kind of almost go in a mushroom shape, if that makes sense. You had to double back in yourself, go around and come all the way back. And the first 2 days they did that, and we did it properly. And the third day they're like, you don't mind, do you? And no. And we scooted back like the wrong way up a one-way street, kind of speeding our way. And like, so they really want to keep you safe, but only in certain occasions. And it was just all completely bizarre. I remember on route, you went past the kind of High Court of Multan, and the policeman just kind of leaned back to me. He was like, High Court, very corrupt. And I was like, brilliant. Okay. I'm pretty sure that's your house. That's like your to do with that. But no, as I said, already it's taking over. I kind of look back on Multan and I think, what a place, what a time. But I think during the time when it was the England World Cup quarterfinal, and you're sat by yourself in kind of the four walls of your hotel at 2 a.m. That was low. But again, something I remember.
Who would have thought you'd be doing mushrooms in Pakistan? hot tip, my first number one tip for freelancing, carry on baggage only. Do not take a suitcase. It is not worth it. It's never worth it. Let's look more broadly at the tour that was. I mean, absolute madness from start to finish. You look at that England team that was here a year ago. It was the most miserable bunch of cricketers I maybe have ever seen. They were so unhappy. No one wanted to be there. I mean, Joss Butler pretty much just retired halfway through the series without even saying anything about it. Nobody wanted to be playing the Ashes in Australia. And then less than a year later, suddenly it's like the most fun roadshow in town. They pound 500 in a day to start the first test. They make 180 in the first session in the second test. The run chase in the third test, they're going at about 9 and over until the end of the day, and you know, until they come back and knock off the last 50 on the fourth morning. I mean, it's an extraordinary sequence of events, and it's not just that you're in Pakistan, but you're in Pakistan watching an England team play like England teams never play. They never look like they're enjoying themselves. Suddenly they're enjoying themselves.
It's been amazing. We kind of knew the process that England were going to follow out here, but we didn't necessarily know what the result was going to be. I kind of assumed it was going to be a 2-1 shootout either way. It would work once or twice, it would fail miserably a third time. But it's just been relentless. I think history has kind of dictated that when presented with flat wickets, you don't throw it away and you grind your way to 500 in a day. Whereas England have had this kind of mindset switch where it's, well, no, it's flat, so let's make the most of it. And they've kind of put their foot down and just kind of kept going. I think it's a happy accident here. Obviously, Johnny Bairstow was probably one of the best, if not the best player in the world over the summer, they've all of a sudden found out they've got Harry Brook, who is now being compared to Virat Kohli by Ben Stokes, which if I was to, if anyone was to compare anyone to Virat Kohli, I'd want it to be Ben Stokes. And he's got this kind of genius about him where I interviewed him for Wisden Cricket Monthly a month ago, and I asked him about how do you scoop 90 mile an hour into the stands for six? And he went, it's fairly self-explanatory, really. You just kind of get in line, put your bat there, and away it goes. And I was like, no, it's not fairly self-explanatory. It is to you. And he kind of has this process of where he's just so unflustered and everything is so obvious of course we would do really well here. Yeah, it feels too simplistic to just say it's a case of mind over matter, but I don't really know what else it is. It feels like the kind of unleashing of their, or the relaxing of their mind has kind of allowed them to access all the kind of the matter of their skill level, as it were. I think that makes sense. And stuff like the Stokes said in a presser today, he said when he got out for a horrible duck in the kind of in the first innings, I think at Rawalpindi, horrible shot, four balls in, wild hack. Went back into the changing room, and Ollie Pope said to him, "Oh, you must be in a pretty good place at the moment." Just because he was like, "If you gave so little of a shit that you're willing to do that, that means you're fine. You're at peace, basically." And they've kind of rescinded. They've kind of got rid of this fear of failure, and are just going out there and kind of knowing that they can back their skill set and that they're probably going to be better than the other team. What I find really annoying about it is it's impossible to speak about without descending into kind of like mindfulness cliches, which potentially means they're right all along, but I have nothing else on that front.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you look at the numbers down the page, I think someone tweeted, it might have been Vish today, the strike rates of the side. They went at 5.5 and over throughout the series. And what you described there, the experience that Jeff and I had in Pakistan was Australia making the decided effort to play on Pakistan's terms. And by that, I mean that they were going to bat at 2.5 and over. They batted into the third day, I think it was at Karachi actually, in order to feel like they had a sufficient buffer before getting to work with the ball. And England have just gone, well, actually, we're going to play on our terms in Pakistan, not on Pakistan's terms. And it's been that, as you say, that shift from a side that was in complete despair at Hobart, Melbourne and Hobart. Especially Hobart stands out to me when everybody stayed on day four and day five. No one flew home early, including the players. So we were just kind of, because Hobart's a pretty small town, you're just running into each other. And they were fucked. It wasn't just like end of tour, Ashes fucked. It was like, we are beyond. And the conversations that we were having on the podcast and we had everywhere. I remember there was a really instructive Sky Cricket podcast at the time where Rob Key spoke at great length about his own misgivings around the English system. And he's had a chance to implement, I guess, a mindset that's underpinned a lot of what's happening through this Stokesian era as captain and Brendan McCullum, of course, coming in as coach at the same time. But yeah, I do wonder the extent that this is going to be misunderstood into the future. I'm already seeing loads of people online saying, well, this just proves there's no need for the high performance review. This just proves everything's fine. I'm interested on your perspective on that, the extent to which this is about this particular group of, what I say 11, 15, 20 people who are around the England squad and what it means for them, but how that can't necessarily be used to prove or disprove that the England system at large is one that's always fit for purpose.
I think Rehan Ahmed's probably actually a useful answer in this, in that if England, you could make an argument that if England trusted the system to produce, to allow him to develop as they wanted him to, he probably wouldn't be playing here. I think they kind of have gone, seen this person. They don't really know what he is. They don't know. They just know it's exciting. And I think I made this point to Vish earlier. I get a bit of the Zach Crawleys about him, in that I think England think, no, he has access to kind of levels 8, 9, 10 of cricket, but he's yet to, he has the thing that no one else has, but he doesn't yet have the thing that everyone else does. And they're kind of trusting him to fill out as a player underneath their guidance more than if they left him to it, to spend 4 years at Leicestershire or 2 years at Leicestershire and however many more at Nottinghamshire, for instance. I think that probably gives you the answer in that, where England think whether a high performance review is necessary, because if they thought it wasn't necessary, then they would just kind of leave this kind of very talented youngster alone. And instead they've drafted him to be their youngest test player ever. Something you said earlier, which I just wanted to pick up on, about England's playing Pakistan, refusing to play Pakistan at their own game. I'm not sure Pakistan are playing their own game over here. I think the selection of the pitches have been a kind of this big talking point, and especially Rawalpindi, of how flat it was. When you combine that with the selection of Muhammad Ali as this kind of like 75 mile an hour dobber, like, he hasn't got into that team by bowling on flat wickets because he'll get panned, as he did. He got into that team because the domestic wickets in Pakistan have been nipping around. They've been producing kind of good cricket, kind of even on even contests between bat and ball. And so Pakistan have kind of almost playing, having returned home after all these years and not playing test cricket there, they're actually kind of almost playing in conditions that are as foreign to them as kind of, that's an exaggeration, that are also foreign to them in the same way it is kind of for England. And it's been completely bizarre because you've had Ramiz Raja talking about how Pakistan can't produce test quality wickets. And it's only a year ago that they had this amazing series against South Africa, and their domestic pitches are literally doing well, like producing good cricket right now. So it's a really bizarre thing to kind of, it feels like kind of fact and fiction. I think Daniel Rasool and Usman Samiuddin at Cricinfo have been holding kind of these comments, the feet to the fire bit of these comments, because I think it's a very easy thing to kind of go, oh, Pakistan flat, dead. England have come here and refused to play Pakistan at their own game. I don't think Pakistan are playing their own game. I think they're kind of frustrated that they haven't had the pitches that they've wanted in this series.
And I mean, Ramiz was saying when we were there, you know, which is not even a year ago, there was no doubt that it was deliberate that Islamabad, that Rawalpindi pitch, was shaved bare to avoid giving any assistance to the Australian bowlers. So at least that's what he was saying at the time. He was saying, why would we give assistance to the visiting bowlers and so on?
Yeah.
Giving the impression that it was a completely deliberate decision. So to then turn around and say, oh, well, we can't produce test quality pitches. I mean, they're two completely different stories. Which one's true is up to people to decide, but they can't both be true at the same time.
It's so weird. He says, I don't get involved in the pitches, but I might fly over some drop-ins from Australia. And it's like, well, that's involved in the whole pitch. Like, that's not like, that's not saying, oh, how should we prepare the surface? But that's saying this is the surface. And it's also a really bizarre obsession with drop-in pitches because, like, they're using Australia because there's a thing called Aussie rules football. Like, it's a shared oval. There's no, like there's not a Pakistan touch rugby league that's happening at the Rawalpindi cricket stadium over the winter, like the summer. Like there's no need.
And why not? Pitches. I mean, personally, like if there isn't,
that's the real scandal. But yeah, it's been completely bizarre. And I don't, yeah, there've been a number of stories presented as fact, which means that there has to be a few fictions in there as well.
And some of that's been picked up on. You mentioned Daniel Rasool. He wrote a really good piece today about Babar Azam at his press conference. He declared yesterday that we've been dominating teams. And it just doesn't hold up. I mean, you step back from the Pakistan story, it's a pretty grim one since 2016. There have been some extraordinary highs in there. But if you look at the central case, to use government speak, like the central case for Pakistan, home or away, has been pretty ordinary for quite a long time since they went to number one in England in 2016. And Babar Azam's been in the middle of that throughout. It's not as though he's a new player anymore. He's a senior player in that side. He's been the captain for 2 years.
It's an excellent piece by Daniel. I really enjoyed it when I read it this morning. And it also made me quite sad because I think the stats that Pakistan have won 10 of their last 40 test matches, and it kind of took away some of the shine of the England win. In my head, I was like, oh, God, we are unbelievably good out here. No, Pakistan have been losing a lot. And it has been this kind of strange kind of delusion wrapped up in it that I guess they're kind of experiencing failure at home on a level that they never have before. There's been these really confused selections. There was four debutants, I think, at Rawalpindi. They picked Zayed Mahmood over Abra Ahmed, even though Abra was playing ahead of Zahid for their domestic team, but Zahid had kind of been around for a little bit, so it was his go. And like, that's not a way to pick a team. And it kind of revealed itself for how kind of foolish it was when Abra came in. They have also been unlucky with their pace attack kind of all falling over and breaking. And these kind of, it's not even a case of these kind of small bits coming together and forming a jigsaw. They're kind of quite significant chunks that are all happening at the same time and have led to this very kind of disjointed and kind of disappointing performance for the home team. I think if there was a kind of positive, I think Abra is a real positive for Pakistan, kind of almost because, like, Ben Duckett was very bullish when he's speaking about it. He's like, oh, he's a leggy with a googly, which is actually quite a compliment in the grand scheme of things. But I think the fact that he is Allegri with a googly and not this mystery spinner who might one day the Rubik's Cube be solved and he'd be panned everywhere, is probably a better indicator of his longevity, potential for longevity in the team, and that he's getting these guys out bowling quote unquote kind of traditional spin. That's the silver lining I'm picking out amidst the kind of cloud of shit, as it were.
So, I mean, the discovery of him and the discovery of Rehan Ahmed for England, what you were talking about before about why they picked him, to me it seems less about worrying about what the system might do to that bowler in England and more just Stokes saying, we can do whatever we want. Like, we can take risks, we can be unorthodox. And that was just, that was almost making a point. Like, picking him was just making a statement in the same way as coming out and playing a hideous Mo fourth ball and getting out, or the same way as coming out and knocking off the first 100 runs of a chase at 9 and over. It was just making sure that they put their money where their mouth is. Like, we are going to do all of the things that you think we shouldn't do. We're going to take every unorthodox step. So, yes, of course, we're going to pick the 18-year-old leg spinner. And, of course, we're going to bat him at first drop. Like, why wouldn't we? Because we can.
It felt like that just came on the way through to you. I think Stokes said at one point, maybe it was after the win at Royal Pindi, he goes, oh, yeah, we'll probably play him. Like, it was just so, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, probably. We'll give him a cap, give him a game. It seems like, kind of furthering Jeff's point, that Stokes is in that zone right now when it comes to making these big set-piece decisions where he is full of so much confidence with McCullum that it's as like it was foretold that he would walk out and take five for on debut as an 18-year-old.
If you were Stokes, why would you doubt yourself at the minute? Yeah. Like, it literally, it's gone perfectly. And I think there is, to his credit, he has spoken, he was speaking today about, like, everything's gone right so far. And kind of the awareness, like, that's not going to last forever. But like Jeff said, like, Ahmed debuted as a leggy batting at number 8 and ended up batting at number 3. That's a very unusual thing to do, unless you're England, where Will Jacks did it the test match before. Like, they do what they want. Ollie Pope kept for 1 million overs in Rawalpindi and then did it for about 60 overs across 2 days and 20 minutes on in Malta. And they're like, he needs a rest now, actually. And they can just, they're just in this process where there hasn't been a failure, there hasn't been a chink in the armor at any point. And when does that happen, and what happens in that moment? And I guess it'll be a case of, I know from the England side of it, it'll be a case of making sure the media kind of stay calm, because just as this can go perfectly for 9 out of 10 games, you could in a year's time have lost 9 out of 10 games, and you've come out at evens. But it's too. Yeah, I can't remember the original question, to be honest. I've kind of gone off on a ramble.
You're allowed to on this show. That's perfectly fine. The it was 1 out of 17 for England ahead of the McCullum Stokes appointments. It's been 9 out of 10 since. I mean, there are a lot of great individual stories that are woven through that. Not least Johnny Bairstow, who's not been available for the last 6 of those wins, but maybe 5 of those wins. He didn't play against South Africa, did he? He hurt his leg in and around that from memory. Anyway, point is that Bairstow's missed a lot of it. He'll come straight back in at the first available opportunity, I'm sure, to strengthen the side yet further. But then you got someone like Ben Duckett, who, as big a fan of Ben Duckett as I am, he was really nowhere near international selection 9 months ago, 10 months ago. I think he might have played on a Lions trip or an England Lions side at some point or another in the last couple of years. But broadly speaking, you wouldn't have thought when they were leaving Hobart last year, the answer's Ben Duckett. And yet what an incredible month it's been in his life. And he'll be a hard bloke to leave out even when Bairstow comes back and they have to recalibrate the side.
I think so. Duckett had a great... I love it when just people who are really good at something just fail to hide that they're really good at it. So he was asked, oh, are you surprised by how well you've gone? He was like, I kind of thought I'd be able to get some runs in these conditions. And you're like, mate, you've averaged 70 in your first 3 tests back in Test cricket. Like, he did then qualify and be like, I'm really happy, etc. But Duckett's an odd one in that he was kind of half a horse for a course over here and half just picked off the back of like sheer weight of runs for Nottinghamshire. Yep. And he'd given some interviews, I think, with Wisden and maybe a few people over time being like, I look at my numbers versus everyone else over the last 3 years. I'm like, why am I not getting a game, basically? And I think he's scored enough runs here that, like, he definitely gets... If he doesn't get to the Ashes now, something really weird's happened. Like, he must have scored, like, minus runs in New Zealand. I think if there's anyone...
Indoor cricket.
If there's anyone who's kind of really be feeling the kind of the fire on their feet, as it were, having their feet held to the fire, something like that, it'll be folks. Like, we mentioned the strike rates earlier. every apart from Jack Leach and Ben Foulkes, mm-hmm. every single person in that England squad had a strike rate between 82 and 100 in that series. Mm-hmm. Ben Foulkes came back and batted beautifully for his 64, but he batted beautifully if it was kind of 1964. I wanted to use a different year there, but like it's not necessarily a style of cricket that is in keeping with what they want to do. And they've also now decided that Ollie Pope, oh yeah, he's good enough for the gloves. Like Ben Duckett is a wicketkeeper.
Mm.
But they also thought that Ollie Pope was good enough to have them anyway. And they just kind of, again, if we talk about those kind of big calls, that was another one that worked with Pope. He took an amazing catch at Rawalpindi that kind of won them, helped win them the game. He kind of caught one in Multan, which turned the game. Everything's kind of turning to gold at the moment for England. And in terms of Ben Duckett, I think that's kind of, it's just been another example of the kind of the Midas touch at the moment where he's come in and performed perfectly.
Cam Ponsonby, you've had a great tour with what you've been writing as well. So I'll encourage everyone to jump on. What's your Twitter handle?
It's my name, at Cameron Ponsonby.
You'll be able to find it easily enough. He's a young gun rising through the England media ranks, and I'm sure having spent a month in Pakistan will only add to that. You'll hear more of him on The Final Word as well, I'm sure. Safe travels back home, and have a Merry Christmas.
Thank you very much, guys, and you too.
Final Word, Adam Collins, Jeff Lemon, as we say goodbye for another week. Thank you to Cam. As we said at the end there, he's a very capable writer. I strongly recommend reading his work, and we're going to be doing some work with him over the next few months as well, Jeff. What else? There's going to be the Christmas special. There's going to be a Storytime edition spliced in before that, because we didn't anticipate making this particular episode. We were going to do it Storytime anyway, so bonus ep this week, I suppose. And then we will have the dailies, and we will keep making stuff even though we're separated by 10,000 miles again.
We will not be stopped. We cannot be stopped. There is no power in heaven or in hell that can stop us making cricket podcasts.
If you want to support what we're doing through this very, very busy period, patreon.com/thefinalword. That's where you can submit a nerd pledge and you can fuel our travels around the cricketing globe, which will include India in no time at all. In the middle of all that, we're having another kid, as you do.
Yeah, me and Adam, we're having another kid.
Which is why I'm back in. Some people ask me that. They go, why aren't you not staying for the Melbourne and Sydney test matches? I'm like, it's the baby we've got coming in January, which is going to preclude me from being there for that in person at least. But I'll still be watching and we'll still be doing our thing.
Mm-hmm. And if you're part of the community, you can do stuff like come to the meetups. We had a nice one at the pub in Brisbane the other night where it should have been day three of the test match, but a bunch of people who listened to the show came down for a chat and a beverage and all the rest of it. And predictably enough, the night ended with, even when most of the listeners to the show had gone home, Ben Jones and Andrew McGlashan were still in the pub arguing about cricket.
Fantastic. You wouldn't want it any other way. Now, this has been episode 12 of season 13 of The Final Word. We'll talk to you again a number of times later in the week.
See ya. So you know what I meant. I had to go.